The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
We are delighted you are spending your afternoon with us. Here we are on the eve of Independence Day. We are Hugh and Lewis Hallman. We are delighted to be with you on the Seth Liebson Show here on KKNT 960 The Patriot. We note that, of course, Seth is on a well-deserved vacation, and in his absence yesterday we took over and created the Hallman Autonomous Zone, and yet we decided, following the pattern in Seattle, that we now have renamed our space the Seth Liebson Occupied Protest, or SLOP. We have been talking to you about the manipulation of numbers and specifically how our state has used numbers to frighten us. And we have Rick with us from Phoenix who wanted to chat with us. So, Rick, you are on the air.
Yeah, in that regard, I think we're making at one time $13,000 per admission for corona. And then if they could hook you up to one of those killer ventilators, they could make about three times that much, or $39,000 per bed. So that would kind of encourage cooking the data in that direction. Also, of course, they were kind of running out of collusions. Ukrainian, Russian, Armenian, whoever comes up next. I'm very upset about this. But the collusions are running out. So let's have a scare pandemic that we could paralyze the economy and somehow trace it to Trump. Every move he makes will get the negative side of that. And then I'm sure the Chinese are having a ball. As our economy crashes, around the time that we were cutting off a whole bunch of sweetheart deals with them because of their cheating. So on those three points, maybe I missed some elaboration there. Maybe you want to add some.
Well, Rick, thank you for the call. In fact, we will add some. You're a perfect launch pad for maybe talking a little bit about the international implications of what's going on. So we've talked previously about data to share with our country about the fact that the news media for a while loved to point out that the United States is a horrible cesspool, a toxic waste dump, and why can't we be more like Europe? And in fact, we've been doing numbers. We did not self-select to make the numbers look better, Rick, but we tried to choose countries that would be indicative of a Western medical approach. So we took countries from Western Europe that were not part of the former Soviet Union, that had had a long history of providing high-end medical care. So we created our COVID U.S. versus Western Europe analysis so we could better understand who's doing a good job and who's doing a bad job. Let me highlight some of the unusual good jobs. You've got Cyprus, the little country of Cyprus, only 1,200,000 people. Total cases as of yesterday, essentially 999. Their total deaths are 19. Their deaths per million are 16. It is the lowest of all European countries. The next lowest of all things is Greece, with only 18 deaths per million. And then if you broaden your look and asked why Greece and why Cyprus, you would find out that they were joined by two other countries in the Middle East, Israel and Lebanon. And the interesting thing about this, no, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. There's a lot of real hard medical work we've got to attend to really understand what's going on. But in this instance, all four of those countries adopted an approach that anybody who tested positive for COVID-19, for SARS-CoV-2, the virus, was immediately administered, of all things, chloroquine. So now you've got Z-Pak and chloroquine being administered abroad, and we've had a lot of controversy in this country about whether or not that's an appropriate protocol. Testing is still going on, and there was a fairly famous example of a study that was done to prove that it was a bad approach.
Which was then redacted. It turned out that all of the data behind that study, put together by a Harvard professor, was falsified. It was unable to be replicated. One of the issues with that
was, by the way, published in The Lancet, which is a world-renowned medical journal, peer-reviewed.
I believe the New England Journal of Medicine also had a similar study that was also redacted at around the same time as well.
So the numbers, Lou, I think you ought to inform folks about sort of the numbers.
Let's get into that. Absolutely. So the big thing, frankly, and we've been saying this all along, that we like to compare, to get really the best apples-to-apples comparison, is looking at death rates. We analyze them in terms of deaths per million, because we want to control for how populated a country is. It doesn't make any sense to compare how many deaths are in Arizona with how many deaths are in New York, because New York has about three times the population Arizona does. It's not really a fair comparison.
So we compare based on the millions, number of people who have the illness, or number of deaths per million people. Some places like to use hundred thousands, but you get into these little decimal points, which are hard to read. So we've been using million as our base. And so the Western European combined total cases is 1.5 million. Well, that's not very meaningful if you don't know that there are 416 million people in those countries. So looking at the cases per million, it is 3,600 cases per million. The United States now is at 8,100 cases per million. So,
but, and there's a heavy but there.
Wait a minute, I was going to say 2.5 times worse.
Right.
But now, Lou, the big but.
The big but is that the U.S. is testing significantly more than those countries.
In fact, we've tested twice as many people as all of those countries combined. So when you take the 416 million people in these European countries and the 331 million people in the United States, those European countries have tested just under 17 million, and the United States has tested just under 34 million.
Let me make a slight correction there. Those absolute figures are true because we don't actually have good data for a number of Western European countries. They, in fact, will not release the statistics as to how many people they are actually tested. They have in dribs and drabs occasionally, so we've seen a very small glimpse, for instance, at the French rate of testing back in April. And I've seen small.
And they wiped out the data.
That's exactly right. And so, at the time, by the way, they were testing at about a third the U.S. rate by population.
So we can give you some specific examples. The only two countries that are reporting data that out-test the United States are Luxembourg, with 625,000 people, and Portugal. Portugal ramped up very, very quickly because they were having such a huge challenge.
It's actually a third country. Denmark as well.
Fair enough.
Which has a population smaller than Arizona. You don't get lots of points with me for having a tiny, homogenous society that can test at a larger scale than the U.S. can. We are a massive continent-spanning state, and the sheer logistical challenge of rolling out all of these tests means that it's taken a while, but we have really very much succeeded at it. Another issue.
Well, don't forget, though, you had news stories through May about how terrible the United States is in not testing. And now that we're testing twice as many people as most European nations,
we're
suddenly
not hearing about it.
Silent. So there's a good news story. So here we are testing. But more interesting to me are the deaths per million. Even with a larger number of people who are showing the coronavirus and COVID-19, the U.S. currently has deaths per million people of 387. 387 people per million have succumbed to the disease. Europe, however, which was touted as so much better than the United States, even with fewer cases reported, has death of 419 people per million.
And that's for Europe as an entire continent. There are many countries which have not been very badly affected, and it's important to contextualize the United States against some of its more peer competitors. So, for instance, the United Kingdom has a fatality rate of 647 per million. Remember, the United States only had 387 per million, nearly half. If you look at Arizona, however, our deaths per million are only 233, a third of the United Kingdom's rate. And Maricopa County's is 158 per million, which is a quarter of the United Kingdom's death rates. Part of the reason that the U.S. has been getting such a bad international rap out of this is that we've had New York and New Jersey, which have been incredible hotspots. If you remove those two states from the U.S. totals, our mortality rate by population, not in absolute numbers, falls by a quarter.
But remember, New York and New Jersey are touted now as being huge successes because, well, I'm not quite sure why. Because if you look at the deaths per million in, say, New York or Massachusetts or New Jersey. So New York, for example, has deaths per million of 1,279.
That's six times the rate in Arizona, nearly.
And New Jersey has 1,687.
Eight times the Arizona rate.
So we appreciate the call. We're going to be back after the break. I'm Hugh Holman. That's Lewis Holman. We want to now talk about the international implications and how this has affected the United States' position on the planet, how we're going to protect ourselves on the globe, and what this means for trade, for example. Our caller talked about the fact that they always blame Donald Trump first to take our former Secretary to the UN's speech a little bit. We want to talk about how that has impacted our position on the globe. I'm Hugh Holman. That's Lewis Holman. We're filling in for Seth Liebson. Here we are on KKNT 960 The Patriot. We'll talk to you after the break. I just hate to cut in on good bluegrass. I'm Hugh Holman. I'm joined by Lewis Holman, the managing director of InsightAnalytics.com. Anybody interested in seeing the actual spreadsheets, the data sources, all that kind of stuff, you can go to Lewis's website at Insight, I-N-C-I-T-E, Analytics, LLC.com, and you'll see all of this stuff. We want you to take a hard look at it, correct our work, tell us we're full of beans. We were talking about before the break the fact that we have an international environment in which the United States is operating, and we were beat up for several months about the fact that the U.S. is in such terrible condition compared to, say, its Western allies. And in fact, as the game has played out, the United States has done relatively well. It's increased testing. It's taking care of its own. Its mortality rates, or what we call a case fatality rate, is lower. It's not clear we're comparing apples to apples because a lot of the countries are manipulating data in the same way that we're seeing these problems in the United States. It's not necessarily evil. Sometimes incompetence is the best explanation for a phenomenon, and never supplant evil or incompetence with evil, because often the case, it's just people struggling to do the best they can. But here we are in an international environment. We learned during this crisis that a huge chunk of the United States critical care supplies were coming from China, and suddenly that got shut off. The PPE supplies that got shut off that were made for American companies that were trying to import them back to the United States, and China said, no, 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 we're keeping them here. The same thing happened with certain medicines, and it's caused Americans to be concerned that, for example, Donald Trump's approach toward China is somehow untoward or going to cause great crises, that the Chinese are going to hold us hostage. And in fact, part of the reason that the market is booming in the United States and we're seeing less struggles than we might otherwise is capital flows. Folks in other parts of the world are saying the one bank they can trust, the piggy bank that doesn't break, is in the U.S. And so huge capital flows are coming back into the United States. But there's a more subtle, careful explanation for that. And for that, I want to turn it over to Lou.
So we hear a lot about the 21st century being made out as the century of the Chinese, that they're now holding us hostage and they're poised to dominate the world. And while those are very interesting hypotheses, I remain utterly unconvinced by them. I am skeptical of the idea that China will even exist as a cogent state in the next two decades. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but I want to first turn you to a dictum that has dominated Chinese strategy since Sun Tzu wrote it 2,500 years ago. And that dictum is that all warfare is based on deception, which means when you are weak, you want to project outward force. When you're strong, you want to project weakness so that your enemy will underestimate you. The Chinese want to engender as much fear of them as possible so that they don't get poked when they're at their weakest. There are a lot of reasons why the Chinese regime is living on borrowed time. So, for instance, China is a large, fairly resource-rich country, but it has over 1.4 billion people in it. China actually has less farmland per capita than Saudi Arabia, Let me repeat that. China has less arable usable land than Saudi Arabia, which is literally, I think, the textbook example of a desert country. So the Chinese are actually more dependent on the global order of trade that has been established since 1946 than we are. Yes, we have vulnerabilities. Yes, some of our manufacturing has moved to China. But the Chinese economy is utterly dependent on the global order that has existed, continuing the way it does. Their export-led economy needs to have the American security umbrella provided by our Navy's operation.
So where'd that come from? I mean, how did we get here? When did this start?
So this all happened immediately after World War II. There was there's something called the Bretton Woods Agreement. So before World War II.
Not for the woods themselves, but really for
the Bretton Woods Hotel, where it was signed and ratified. But the issue is that before 1946, if you saw something you wanted out in the world, you used your own navy, you went out and you took it. But the issue
was, British were famous for this.
Exactly. You colonized, you expanded into empire, and that was sort of the way the world worked. But after World War II, the Americans were the only people with a functional military and a functional navy. And so rather than going back to the old imperial
order, everything else having been blown up or sunk.
That's correct. So rather than going back to that old way of everyone has their own navy and they all do their own colonial empire thing, we said, stop. Here's what we're going to do instead. We will use our navy to protect the oceans for everybody. You can go out to any other country in the world, get resources, bring them home, do a bunch of value-added manufacturing, and then ship them wherever you want to go. It's the entire basis for the German manufacturing sector, South Korean manufacturing sector, the Chinese manufacturing sector. It's how everything is done now. It's why globalization's happened.
So in part, the reason that the Chinese, or the Germans, and others can afford to create manufacturing capacity is because they're not paying for the cost of protecting the oceans blue. That cost is borne entirely by the U.S., more or less.
That's exactly right. And the issue that they have, the big strategic pickle that they're in, is that they...
That is the Chinese.
The Chinese, excuse me, yes. That they cannot recreate these conditions without the Americans' help. So, for instance, the China on paper has more ships in its navy than the United States does. But only a ninth of them are capable, that's 11% of them, are capable of operating more than 1,000 miles from the Chinese coast. They can't sustain the kind of cargo flows of export flows that they would need in order to keep their economic engine moving, because they couldn't muscle up and form convoys to protect them. Navies,
in other words, they're dependent on the U.S. protection even for the Chinese import and export through their own ships.
That's exactly right. If we were to take aggressive action against the Chinese, we wouldn't even need to sail into the South China Sea. We could just blockade the Straits of Malacca and then stop them from moving all of their energy from the Persian Gulf into China.
Now, wait a minute. Think about what he just said. So the Chinese are taking energy out of the Middle East like we used to. We're now an energy-producing country, but the Chinese are now still an energy-importing country. And to get that energy out of the Middle East, they're dependent on the U.S. Navy.
Right. And the issue is that they need that energy not only to keep all of their modern economy going so that they can keep the factories operating, but even to keep them fed. Over the last 100 years, China has urbanized incredibly, and in doing so, it's paved over its most productive arable land. So part of the consequences of that is that they need to use massive amounts of petroleum-based fertilizers in order to keep their agricultural sector productive. And even with that, they are still the number one importers in the world of rice, barley, pork, frozen fish, and dairy. And they import more soy than all other countries on Earth combined. They're very, very vulnerable in ways that we do not appreciate.
So when we come back after the break, I'm going to ask Lewis to talk about the relative dependence on international trade. We're often told that the United States is absolutely dependent on international trade. And in fact, I think you'll be shocked by what the real numbers are. He's Lewis Holman. I'm Hugh Holman. You're on KKNT 960, The Patriot. We're grateful that you're listening. Please do join the conversation if you'd like at 602-508-0960. We're grateful to Seth Liebson for allowing us to sit in for him. We have, however, taken over his studio. You are now listening to the Seth Liebson
occupied protest.
Slop. We look forward to the conversation after the break. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman. We are filling in for our good friend Seth Liebson, who's taking a much-needed vacation. Well-deserved, but we have taken over his entire studio. Yesterday, we designated it the Hallman Autonomous Zone, but in honor of the new form of government in our United States, it is now the Seth Liebson Occupied Protest, or SLOP. We were talking before the break about the U.S.'s position in the international environment and the original perception that people have been fed that the United States is somehow dependent on China for its survival. And Lewis has been explaining from, frankly, since the end of World War II, that the U.S. has been set up to be the only source of survival for most of the other countries on the planet. Lou, why don't you finish it up?
That's exactly right. So, and again, I don't want to utterly sweep under the rug. There are very legitimate criticisms and strategic problems with the fact that much of our manufacturing has been outsourced to China. You know, our PPE has been made there. But the good news is that these are things we can fix. You know, you can just look at the domestic expansion of mask production to see very, very clear evidence of that. These are issues that Americans can solve with grit and ingenuity. The Chinese, however, are not in that same kind of position. They are stuck living off of American security largesse and hoping that, you know, the precarious house of cards that they have built won't get knocked over, you know, by outside forces. They need to have the American security order in order to feed their population and get enough energy to keep the lights running. But let's look at the sort of the interconnectedness of each country.
Well, what I think would be useful for folks to understand, because we've all been fed the notion that all of our manufacturing has been outsourced. We're completely and entirely dependent on foreigners to supply our goods and services that we need. Although, gee, in the last few years, we've now turned into a energy independent nation, one of the few on the planet.
That's exactly right. That's
and actually, how does that match up with everything else?
So I actually want to touch on that, the energy independence. That's almost entirely as a result of the shale oil revolution. As of 2000, we were a very large net energy importer, but now we actually produce more oil and at a lower cost point than Saudi Arabia, which is staggering.
Think about that. This is Saudi Arabia is a country where oil leaks out of the ground, or at least it used to. And now the United States, through the application of technologies, has been able to not only increase its oil production for its own uses, but is now exporting some energy. It's caused some folks to go sort of crazy in the United States that we're now using greater fossil fuels because they're now cheaper. It's interesting to me that the fracking controversies are so heated, no pun intended, given that fracking produces natural gas that ultimately is cleaner burning.
And but, subsidizes all of U.S. energy prices and has done so for the past decade. It's the reason that they've remained relatively stagnant. So, for instance, your power bill has not really been increasing year over year in nearly the same way it has everywhere else in the world.
And what's interesting, when there was oil shocks in the last year, there was a blip in the United States momentarily, and then the market went, the U.S. is fine. We've got plenty of oil, plenty of gas. And that we're not actually at stake for what happens in the Middle East.
Actually, it's also the case that that's true because of the actual structural nature of fracking itself. It actually only takes about 6 weeks to go from nothing to getting a fully functional fracking operation up and running. The same is not true of the more traditional kinds of oil extraction, which can take years to set up. So when those close down because of market issues, they then can't come back up again. So there's a whole different kind of nimbleness to the U.S. energy sector that literally everywhere else in the world doesn't have. But I think we've spent a moment talking about oil.
Yeah, but I think the big point is a step one to the United States independence from the rest of the world, in contrast to the rest of the world's dependence on the United States. We start with energy as a big piece of that, that this is a country that needs that energy because of the kinds of activities this country engages in. It still is a manufacturing behemoth. Yes, a lot has been put into China. A lot has gone to Germany and other places. But the United States still is quite a powerful organization. When we come back, we want to talk about the real proof that the United States is more independent than you've been led to believe, and how the rest of the world is continuously dependent on the United States. We'll come back and talk about that. He's Lewis Hallman. I'm Hugh Hallman. You're listening to KKNT 960 The Patriot. We're thankful to Seth Liebson for allowing us to sit in on his show. We have, however, taken it over, and maybe he'll get it back on Monday. Tomorrow, you're going to get to hear the best of Seth Liebson. And Seth, as Lewis said, with his brilliant brain on, will be back in this chair on Monday. We look forward to talking to you after the break. Again, I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman, and you're listening to KKNT 960 The Patriot. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman. We are with you on KKNT 960 The Patriot. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd like to have you at 602-508-0960. We were just discussing the fact that most Americans have been left with the impression that the United States is now being held hostage, can be held hostage by China and other places on the planet, that the bad news is that especially the coronavirus and COVID-19 have proved up that we're dependent on China for our medicines, we're dependent on China for our PPE and a whole host of other things. And yet, as Lewis noted before the break, we can fix most of that, but China's in a position where it can't. And it's because it's dependent on others for their fuels, for their fertilizers, for their food. And all of that's dependent on having the oceans protected by the U.S. Navy. And as long as we play along and pay for all of those costs, China, Germany, other places on the country can avoid costs of that protection, manufacture goods without that hidden burden on their economy. And we, on the other hand, have that hidden burden, which ultimately gets charged to all of us through increased taxes and additional costs. But in fact, it is not the case that the United States is dependent on the rest of the world for our foodstuffs, our goods, our services, and that the rest of the world is somehow independent. The opposite is true. Lewis will explain how.
Absolutely. So the big issue, really what you want to think about in terms of this sort of globalization issue and vulnerability, is how much of our economy actually is dependent on exchanging things with the wider world. And the interesting thing about that is that the U.S. is effectively the least globally integrated wealthy country in the world. Only about 8% of our GDP is...
GDP being gross domestic product.
That's correct.
That is, of all the stuff made and sold around, only 8% of it is...
Tied up in imports and exports. About half of that is tied up in NAFTA, or what the successor to NAFTA is. I believe it was renegotiated, and
that's
I cannot
correct.
Now remember
Donald
the
Trump
acronym.
Got a new agreement between Mexico and Canada so that the trade within the three countries is about half of that total. And so Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. are trading about half the total of the dependent number that the U.S. has. It's about 8% of the total GDP, 4% within North and Central America.
That's exactly right. And so the issue then is that our total exposure that's not within our own North American system is 4% of our economy, which admittedly is, you know, a fair bit of stuff. The U.S. economy is massive. It's $20 trillion. You know, so that represents about $1 trillion worth of goods that we buy and sell each year back and forth. The issue, though, is that every other developed country is much more nestled into the global system than we are.
Meaning more dependent on everybody else.
So, for instance, Germany, that number is 40%, not 4%. Can you imagine that? The amount of uncertainty and stability that would exist if 40% of American goods came from elsewhere?
Well,
40% of the American economy, not even the goods, all of the services, the agriculture, everything. It's a whole different neighborhood, and all of those goods, all of those globalized trade flows, if the Americans left away, are then subject to the mad winds of history. It's very vulnerable.
In fact, that's the explanation in part for what happened in World War I and World War II. Germany, looking to secure the supplies they needed for their own well-being, coal and other kinds of resources that they had to get from outside Germany's border. That led to these continuous conflicts. That's led to World War II. It led to World War I. And the same conflicts with the other societies within Europe and the Soviet Union or Russia. China. Tell us about China.
So China is the largest exporter in the world. Its goods are not consumed by its own population. They must go out of China and then be sold out to the broader world.
In exchange for
the securing of their trade flows, all of the food and raw commodities that they import, all of the other things that make their economy function because they're not domestically sourced.
So the Chinese society exports a whole bunch of stuff in exchange, for example, when it exports to the United States, China gets back pictures of dead presidents. It then takes those pictures of dead presidents and uses them to buy the stuff they absolutely have to have. Fuel, food, all the kinds of things that they're not creating enough of in their own society while they've been creating manufacturing capacity to sell stuff and get hard currency in exchange for the stuff they need. Currency is just a means of exchange. So what they're really doing is selling us stuff like televisions and iPhones in exchange for food and oil and other things that the Chinese people need that they don't currently make themselves.
That's exactly right. And on that point, there's another issue. It's no secret that the Chinese system relies on very, very weird systems of massive government debt, just continually poured upon everything. Let me do a little comparison here. In the run-up to the Great Recession, the 2007-2008 financial crisis, the U.S. system had about a doubling in terms of its credit. The amount of money that was being lent around to people, the amount of debt just about doubled over a decade. That's a pretty big increase. And the correction then slowed that after the recession and moved our debt increase to more historically regular levels. China, in contrast, if you look at the past two decades, has seen a 4.5-fold expansion of their gross domestic product. That is the size of their economy. But their credit has increased 24-fold. The bubble that China is hiding and propping up desperately with every fiber of its being is going to make the Great Recession look just like a happy day, a calm, peaceful period.
Not to the Chinese. And that's actually what our greatest concerns are, is the destabilizing impact of having China deal with the fact that it's got this massive debt load and it's got a population of people that are having to service that debt load through their activities so that China can continue to manufacture enough to sell to cover over and paper over the massive borrowing that the Chinese have had. Now, while Lewis and I are both horrified by the fact that the Congress has already issued $3.5 trillion in paper in order to give us all a raise of $1,200. A very small part of that expenditure, by the way, went to American citizens.
12% went to families.
Almost all of the rest of it went into expansion of our credit and a variety of other things. The Chinese, on the other hand, have this problem orders of magnitude larger than the United States. When we come back, we're going to finish up on this topic and we're going to bring you into the 5 o'clock hour talking about the impact on our society of government's misuse of its political capital with Americans, how this coronavirus has been used to undermine our own faith in our society. That's probably the most important issue we think we could talk about on the eve of Independence Day, where lots and lots of Americans gave their lives in order to secure liberty for their progeny. And here we sit enjoying that opportunity. I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman. We're coming to you from the studios of KKNT 960 The Patriot. Thank you to Seth Liebson for allowing us to fill in for him. We'll come to you after the break. to cut out great music like that. Sure hate to cut out great music like that. But I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman. We've been talking about the international scene and trying to dispel the rumor that the United States is somehow being held hostage by China. We had a terrible experience. And, of course, the news media kept beating this drum. The U.S. is dependent on Chinese goods, the PPE, the drugs that we need, the materials we need, ventilators. And it's all Donald Trump's fault, by the way, because he's been mean to them. And, in fact, as Lewis has been explaining, the Chinese are more dependent as any society than almost anybody else on the planet, and the U.S., in fact, is more independent than almost any other society.
That's exactly right. Whether we're talking food production, energy markets, or even the relative exposure to international trade and the ability to protect the oceans, China fails on every front while the U.S. succeeds. The final nail in the coffin, though, is demography. Starting in 1976, with Mao's Great Leap Forward, the regime unveiled the one-child policy. I believe it was the two-child policy first and then changed to the one-child policy later. That has caused an unbelievable demographic ripple effect. Not only does the Chinese have 40 million more men than women, more than the population of California, by the way, they have now gotten old before getting rich. The median Chinese is now older than the median American. And that is absolutely going to change the entire way their economy works. They will now be retiring into pensioners without being able to sustain more and more growth. So
we feel we have it bad enough because we have more pensioners now on Social Security who are being supported by our workforce, which has also shrunk. But the Chinese?
They actually call it the 421 problem, where there will soon be four grandparents for every two older working people for every one child. It's going to just... It's the inverse of how a society should look, frankly. It's a dependent society with no ability to produce anymore. And it will be, in all likelihood, I suspect, the absolute end of the Chinese regime and the Chinese as a state. It is going to be a spectacular undoing.
Yeah, but think about it. If you're the kid, all the gifts you get on your birthday, you only got one of them to get, you know, you got six people upstream to give you gifts. That's a pretty good deal.
All those Social Security taxes you get to pay, I'm sure. It must be, that's a really unenviable position, frankly.
Yeah, I suppose. So the United States is suffering with some of these same challenges as our young people have fewer children and then are taking care of in the lifestyle to which we older folks would like to become accustomed. I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman. We want to come back at the top of the hour to talk to you about what then are the consequences of the insanity that our country has been subject to?
Now that we've dispelled the myths about the U.S.-China competition, we want to talk about how we're then able to live our lives with more courage and act without fear on the international scene and domestically.
So while we've got folks talking to us about coronavirus and COVID-19 data and explaining that we need to be in our homes to stay safe, not going to challenge you on that. You want to stop the spread of any disease, you stay away from other people. The real question is, we've got to cost benefit and weigh our options, spend our resources on the people who need it. When we come back, we'll talk about what the consequences have been to our society. I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman, KKNT 960 The Patriot.